Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Borisaj, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, who examines the task of organizing effective opposition to Donald Trump and the GOP agenda. George Lakey, author of Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too, who discusses the Nordic countries' successful economic policies that help them create a more egalitarian society. And lifelong peace and social justice activist Ted Glick, who talks about why he's launched a water-only fast to pressure President Obama to grant Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier executive clemency. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a New Year's Day address, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un pledged to deploy an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of launching a nuclear warhead to hit the mainland of the United States. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump dismissed the nuclear threat, tweeting, "It won't happen." Outside observers now estimate the secretive North Korea state has more than enough nuclear material to build a dozen nuclear warheads and actively develop an advanced missile program. American presidents since Bill Clinton have tried and failed to make a nuclear deal with Pyongyang in exchange for aid. Although an agreement was negotiated in 1994 to assist North Korea to develop nuclear power for the generation of electricity and normalize relationships with the United States, the deal collapsed. Both George W. Bush and Barack Obama tried various strategies to contain North Korea's nuclear program, but failed. After a new round of nuclear tests by Pyongyang last year, the United Nations Security Council, including China, imposed new sanctions against North Korea. Beyond putting more pressure on China, North Korea's main ally, there are few means to pressure Pyongyang to curtail its push for the expansion of its nuclear weapons arsenal. North Korea could quickly become Donald Trump's first and extremely dangerous foreign policy crisis. As hundreds of thousands of people fled from war-torn Syria last year, local officials and communities across eastern Germany mobilized to settle refugees and to integrate them into the workforce. A top priority was to enhance the refugees' work skills and fast-track them into skilled positions in Germany's export economy. On a practical level, it meant full-time work internships for refugees in established small and medium-sized enterprises. According to the Christian Science Monitor, in some aging regions in Germany, there is currently a shortage of interested workers to fill existing apprenticeship training openings. Yet the educational level of most Syrian refugees is lower than prospective German apprentices. So there is a push to allow flexibility in training standards in order to integrate more refugees. "It's a serious commitment," said Stefan Tauber, who helps administer a refugee work program in eastern Germany's Thuringia region. "We're talking about giving refugees a real, long-term work perspective as qualified workers, not as jobbers who make quick money and disappear." San Quentin inmate Chris Schumacher is eager to join the high-tech economy. He currently makes a good wage in prison by sitting behind a computer screen doing complex calculations for a fast-moving Silicon Valley startup. Schumacher, who's enrolled in the Last Mile Works program, is in jail for killing a drug dealer. He's now looked forward to getting job offers once he's released from prison. Currently, the United States has the highest percentage of its population in prison in the world, with 2.3 million adults behind bars. The massive number of U.S. inmates was fueled by stiff sentences imposed with the failed war on drugs. Two-thirds of former inmates are rearrested within 3 years of their release. Computer coding came to San Quentin Prison, which houses the largest number of death row inmates in the United States, through Chris Redlitz, a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. His goal is to break the cycle of mass incarceration. The program is currently expanding into 5 other California prisons and has drawn interest from several other states, including Washington State, where local community colleges are now offering computer coding classes in 2 state prisons. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
When billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump takes the oath of office on Inauguration Day, January 20th, he'll be taking up residence at the White House as one of the most unpopular presidents in modern U.S. history. In addition to losing the popular vote to Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton by 2.8 million ballots, Trump's Electoral College victory of 306 votes ranks near the bottom, belonging somewhere between the lowest one-fourth and the lowest one-fifth of all Electoral College wins in the history of U.S. presidential elections. A new poll from Quinnipiac University finds that Trump will enter the presidency with a 37% favorable rating versus a majority of 51% of those polled who view the Republican unfavorably. When pollsters asked those surveyed whether they thought Trump's behavior since the election made them feel better or worse about him, 28% said they feel worse, with just 23% saying they feel better. As Inauguration Day approaches, the media and much of the nation will be focused on the U.S. Senate confirmation hearings for Trump's nominees to fill his new administration's cabinet. Major controversies have erupted over nominees' history of racist views, conflicts of interest, climate change denial, support for the privatization of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and public education, as well as multiple Trump appointees who have worked for Goldman Sachs and who advocate for corporate and Wall Street deregulation. Your reporter spoke with Robert Borisage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Here he examines the task of organizing effective opposition against the Trump GOP agenda and the Democratic Party's urgent need for new leadership and energy.
Well, of course, the confirmation hearings, if Senator McConnell, the leader of Republicans in the Senate, has his way, will come and go in a blink of an eye. And his hope is to drive them through the hearings very quickly without anybody noticing. While Democrats, I think, have to find ways to slow this down and to demand that people have a chance, the Americans have a chance to get a good look at who these nominees are and the conflicts that they bring with them. I think that's going to happen much more quickly than one would like. Then we go into the, right away, the reconciliation bill, the first bill Republicans, first order of business, as Mike Pence puts it, will be the repeal of the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare. And here Republicans, I think, begin to unravel because their promise is to repeal and replace the law, but they don't have anything to replace it with. And so they're now saying they're going to repeal it without replacing it and wait 2 years, 4 years to come up with a replacement, which will undoubtedly lead states and insurance companies and hospitals and doctors to begin to unravel the act. And people are going to start getting hurt immediately by this decision. And Democrats have to be stalwarts in opposing that and in pointing out the folly, the utter kind of irresponsible and immoral folly involved in that. But I think the bigger and harder task is to not just oppose the stupidity and the really criminal policies that we're going to face, whether it's tax cuts on the rich or kind of total retreat from addressing climate change or the horrors that could well be visited on people of color and particularly on undocumented workers and Muslims. In addition to opposing this and raising a different voice, it's really important, it seems to me, for Democrats, particularly progressives, to lay out big ideas that offer an alternative. It's important for people to understand it is a choice between truly reactionary and profoundly wrong policies and big ideas that could, you know, provide basic rights for Americans from health care, affordable health care, to affordable college, to full employment, and to, you know, empowering workers to organize and win a fair share of the profits and productivity they're producing. All of those policies are possible, but they have to be argued out even as we oppose what's coming down the pike from Trump and company.
When you look at the Democratic Party in the upcoming leadership contest, two of the main contenders being Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison and Labor Secretary Tom Perez to become the next Democratic National Committee chair, do you see the Democrats going in the right direction, both in terms of a strategy of grassroots organizing and also coming up with the vision thing of not only opposing the Trump agenda, but as you said, really putting forth some bold new ideas that the country seems quite ready for, given the popularity of both Bernie Sanders and the fake populism of Donald Trump?
Well, I think the election's a big choice for Democrats. You know, Keith Ellison is an extraordinary candidate, and he's made an extraordinary sacrifice by saying that he would leave his congressional seat if he's elected to lead the party. And Ellison is remarkable because he has perfected in his own district the kind of grassroots organizing that keeps the party alive between elections and builds its strength and creates volunteers and creates energy so that it is not reliant on very big money and it's not compromised in the way that it has been. And that's the model that he wants to take through the DNC and across the country and build in 50 states. He would be, I think, a consensus choice for the position, except for two things. One is he supported Bernie Sanders in the primaries, and while he worked very hard for Hillary once she won the nomination, he was a forceful advocate for Sanders, and there are a lot of sort of what you would call machine Democrats in the DNC who are resentful about the Sanders challenge and who therefore are skeptical about Keith's candidacy. And then I think President Obama wants to maintain his finger on the party, even though he has basically it's been disemboweled under his leadership. He was key to getting Perez to put his hat in the ring. Now, Perez is a terrific labor secretary and a remarkable man and leader, but he has literally no political experience and no organizing experience in politics, unlike Ellison. And so he's really a placeholder for people who want the party to be what it has been, which is this mix of very big money on the one hand and identity politics on the other, without a real emphasis on populist economics and on building a grassroots base. And so I think it's a big choice for Democrats when they come down to this election.
That was Robert Borisage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Find more information on groups organizing opposition to the Trump GOP agenda by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the 2016 Democratic presidential primary campaign, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders defied predictions to become a wildly popular candidate with passionate grassroots support who almost beat former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In the end, Sanders supported Clinton in her unsuccessful bid for the White House. But along the way, the independent Democratic Socialist pressured the former senator and first lady to adopt key policy positions, including support for free public college tuition, advocating for a public health care option, and opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. While he was on the campaign trail, Sanders often talked about his admiration for and the accomplishments of the Scandinavian countries of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. The Vermont senator contrasted the rising inequality in the U.S. with a different system and values in a nation like Denmark, where he said, quote, "Instead of promoting a system which allows a few to have enormous wealth, they've developed a system which guarantees a strong minimal standard of living to all, including the children, the elderly, and the disabled," unquote. The view among a growing number of Americans that the U.S. economic system is broken is one major reason why Sanders' progressive populism and advocacy of democratic socialist policies gained such passionate support. Your reporter spoke with George Lakey, a Quaker activist and mentor in the practice of nonviolent social change, whose new book is titled Viking Economics: How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. Here, Lakey discusses the Nordic countries' successful economic policies that, if adopted in the U.S., could help Americans build a more egalitarian society. He begins by describing his fascination with Scandinavian economics while studying in Norway in 1959.
In 1959, when I got there, they were still experiencing rationing from the Second World War times. That's how hard the war was when they were occupied by Nazi Germans. And they were still rationing in order to make things work for everybody. But what I noticed was it was making things work for everybody, and they'd already pretty much gotten rid of poverty during that period since Second World War.
Well, George, maybe you can talk about the key economic policies that are really guiding the success of these Scandinavian countries in their effort and accomplishment at building an egalitarian society. And the other part of that, of course, is that this system didn't happen overnight, that there was a hard-fought battle over many years, that there were protests and nonviolent civil disobedience actions and a challenge to power that won the day.
That's right. 100 years ago, they were a mess. That's why so many Norwegians came to this country, and Swedes and Danes. And those countries were hemorrhaging their own population. There was so much poverty and so much misery and you know, real hunger and lack of opportunity. And they had to turn themselves around. And they also had a pretend democracy, which is what I frankly think we have in our country right now. They had a parliament that, you know, looked like a democratic thing, and they had elections, free elections, and yet it just turned out that the economic elite always got its way. So what they had to do was to tangle with the economic elite. And one of the things they had going for them was a way superior understanding of economics. The economists who worked with the workers and farmers over in Scandinavia came up with a very different approach. They said what really produces a strong economy for a country is the workers, is the farmers, is the middle-class people who manage the units of production and supervise and design jobs and so on, and do training, job training and education. It's those sorts of people who actually, when they are working at their maximum, we will find an economy that's working at its maximum. And so the way to do that is to value work and really get behind people so that they can work at their most effective. Therefore, free university, free education, free job training, free guidance, counseling for people, because what we don't want in our economy is square pegs in round holes. We want people who are really fitted to find job satisfaction. And that's what makes people innovative. That's what makes people creative and productive.
George, I wanted to ask you about some of the major obstacles that a lot of people discuss and the whys and wherefores of how America could adopt some of the important elements of the Scandinavian economic model. And you often hear obstacles such as, well, Scandinavian nations have a homogeneous society, and here we have a heterogeneous society with a lot of diversity and a lot of racism, unfortunately, a lot of scapegoating. We saw examples of that most recently in the 2016 election campaign. There's a lot of class conflict in this country that doesn't seem to play as well in the Scandinavian countries.
Demagogic appeals to scapegoating people thrive when there is actual economic injustice. That is, when people are feeling resentful, when people are experiencing the economy as a scarce place. So, for example, the decision in Nordic economics is to have full employment rather than unemployment. It makes a huge difference. We have a lot of working class people whose jobs haven't just flattened out in terms of, you know, ability to generate more income, but even reduced income over the years. Then you're going to have a lot of frustrated people who are going to want to take it out on somebody. And so that just asks for demagogues to say, well, it must be the immigrants who are underselling your labor, and that's the reason, or it must be something else that's getting in your way. Instead of really pointing to the leadership of the economy and saying, hey, maybe the leadership of the economy isn't really doing a good job. Maybe we could do a better job if we created a democracy here and made the economy work for the common good.
That was George Lakey, author of the book Viking Economics: How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. Learn more about Scandinavian economic policies and social model by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Native American activist Leonard Peltier and his supporters believe his last hope of leaving prison alive after 41 years lies with an order of executive clemency from President Barack Obama before he leaves office on January 20th. Peltier, a member of the American Indian Movement, was convicted of murdering two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Lakota Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. No evidence has ever been presented tying him to the crime, and he's always maintained his innocence. Peltier's trial was riddled with legally deceptive maneuvers by the prosecution side, including perjury, intimidation of witnesses, withholding of evidence, and more. An appellate judge who had presided over one of Peltier's appeals in the 1990s stated upon retirement that Peltier had not received a fair trial. And on January 4th, U.S. Attorney James Reynolds, who was involved in the prosecution of Peltier's case, urged President Obama to grant clemency, stating it would be in the best interest of justice in considering the totality of all matters involved. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with lifelong peace and justice activist Ted Glick, who has participated in 17 fasts, one as long as 42 days, including many since 1992, calling for Peltier's release. Glick launched another water-only fast on January 2nd, where he says he'll continue until either President Obama grants clemency or until he leaves office on January 20th. Here, Glick talks about his experiences fasting for a cause, the results he's seen from conducting previous fasts, and what he hopes to accomplish with this one.
I have actually fasted for at least 12 days, I think 17 times. Many of them, as a matter of fact, were in the period between 1992 and 2001. And the first year, 1992, which of course was the 500th anniversary of Columbus arriving in the Americas, there was actually a 42-day fast that I was part of.
Fasting is a big sacrifice, and you often don't know what impact it has. So can you say why you do it?
My fasts have usually, the first ones were not ones that I initiated, but I liked the idea. I liked the specifics of the particular idea at the particular time in history that they were proposed. As it's turned out, you know, I'm now more open to doing this. I do think it's one tool that can be used to try to underline the urgency of a particular issue. That's clearly, to me, when you use it, when there's a really urgent issue. And there's no question that right now, it's a very urgent issue for Leonard Peltier and for the people who support him and for indigenous people in general, because if he doesn't get out because of Obama granting him executive clemency, he probably won't survive. He'll probably die in prison. That's I think, a realistic likelihood if he doesn't get out under Obama. I'm fasting probably above every other reason to urge people who hear about this to do what they can to be contacting the White House and to be getting other people to contact the White House right now in this really critical period to urge Obama to do the right thing.
Ted Glick, it's hard to say what kinds of actions lead to the desired changes, but do you feel any of your fasts have been successful, however you define that?
I think they've been successful. In the very first one that I did in prison, related to Phil and Dan Berrigan, there were changes in the way the federal prison system dealt with prisoners as far as parole. That was a big part of the reason for the fast. And also, Dan Berrigan and Phil Berrigan got out of prison years earlier than they had been told by the parole board that they were going to. They had been both turned down. And the fast that Phil initiated led to them getting out of prison, several years earlier than they would have otherwise, most likely. So that probably is one reason why I've c- continued to do them because I have seen success with them. But beyond that, fasting is one tactic that you use when you are working on an issue, part of a movement. There are other tactics, of course, and you know, oftentimes you really don't know whether a demonstration or a petition campaign or letter writing or call-ins, it's hard to make a direct connection between which tactic was most effective. But whatever the tactic is, it's always important to be about building consciousness and knowledge on the part of people who didn't know about the issue, being very much about movement building, getting more people actively involved. And certainly fasting, I think, is very helpful along those lines, because when somebody does a fast, a long fast, you know, it kind of makes people stop and think, you know, when they hear about it, well, why are they fasting? Why are they doing this? Why are they putting themselves through this? And it's very helpful that way to get people to think about the issue or to think more about what they're doing on the issue, to encourage people to take stronger action. The very specific issue is in the context of the Standing Rock uprising and the indigenous uprising really happening around the country, the connections that have been made as a result of that Standing Rock struggle. It is very much consistent with that for Obama to grant executive clemency to Leonard Peltier to show that he gets it. There are indigenous leaders of many of the indigenous nations who have called for Leonard Peltier's release. He has been in prison for 41 years. He is 72 years old. He is in very bad health. And there is a great deal of legitimate outrage at the trial where he was convicted. There were all kinds of irregularities. The FBI definitely engaged in lies and intimidation of witnesses and so on. That's documented in many places. So long ago, he should have, at the very least, had a genuinely fair trial, and that never happened. So there's lots of reasons why he should be let out.
That was lifelong peace and justice activist Ted Glick, who began a water-only fast on January 2nd to urge others to contact President Obama to ask that he grant executive clemency to imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier. Find more information on the campaign seeking clemency for Peltier by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.